I'm not going to introduce our guest yet. I've got one thing to say first. Whoever he is, he's only too welcome to sign autographs, but only one per customer, not one for three or four other people. So if you come up and manage to get him in the corner to sign some autographs, just one, please. Our guest today is pretty special. He's the real hometown hero. He's been looking down on our little city and all the world's other little cities and oceans and deserts and storms for week after week. If we've been lucky, we've seen his little track in the sky. He's the evening star, and perhaps the morning and afternoon star too. He's had to do extraordinary things to get here, to get there, our modest and purposeful Adelaide engineer, to have legs of gossamer turned into leads of lead, to have learnt to speak Russian, to be good enough to be chosen in the first place. Please welcome our own astronaut and semi-cosmonaut, Dr. Andy Thomas.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming to hear me sing for my supper here. It's a pleasure to be here. I had no idea that there'd be quite so many people here, and I'm very complimented that you all came to hear what I have to say. What I'm going to do is talk about my flight on the Mir space station earlier this year by narrating a video that I think captures sort of the essence of the flight and the experience. So if you're unable to see a screen reasonably clearly, I would encourage you to move somewhere perhaps so that you can. Many of you may remember that I flew in space for the first time 2 years ago, and after that flight I had to make some decisions as to what I would do next and what were the opportunities for a second flight. And at that time, we at NASA had started a collaborative program with the Russians to fly NASA astronauts on the Russian Mir space station. This program is a precursor to the International Space Station program that we're beginning next year. Well, I looked at that program and I thought that would be an extraordinary thing to do, to go to Russia and learn to become a cosmonaut, learn Russian, learn about the Russian spacecraft, and then fly on a Russian space station. So last year, at the beginning of last year, I was sent to Russia to the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center just outside Moscow, where traditionally all the Russian cosmonauts have been trained since the days of Yuri Gagarin. And I undertook a crash course in the Russian language and an equally fast course in the systems that they use on the Russian space station Mir, as well as the systems they use in the Soyuz capsule, which is the main form of transport that they use to go to and from the Russian space station. The space capsule is called Soyuz. That was a very tough undertaking, I would have to say, because all of that training that I did was in front of instructors who gave it all in Russian, and I didn't have an interpreter. And then, just to make it worse, at the end of that, they would bring in a panel of specialists and sit me in front of them, and then I would take an exam on that technical content of the systems in Russian, and I had to give my answers in Russian. That's probably the toughest thing I've ever done, probably tougher than flying on the Mir space station, actually. It was a great intellectual challenge, to say the least. But anyway, I did pass my exams, to the surprise of many, including myself, and then at the end of last year, I left Russia and returned to Houston, where I'm normally based, and completed about a month of training to prepare for the shuttle flight that was going to take me up to the Russian space station and drop me off there. That shuttle flight was shuttle flight number STS-89 and was in January of this year. So this experience on Mir really began in earnest on January the 22nd of this year when I flew on the shuttle Endeavour to the Mir space station. And the video that I'm going to show picks up at that point and will start with the day of launch. So perhaps we could start the video and maybe dim these lights a little bit. They're right in my face. And I hope you can all see it. I can't even see that one, so I'll assume it's the same as this one. And this was the day of launch, a few hours before launch. Launch was about 9:30 in the evening, and here I am with the crew of STS-89. And once we had a meal together, we then donned these orange suits that you've seen us wear in the various launch sequences that provide protection in the event of high-altitude bailout. Climbed into the bus that took us out to the launch pad, walking down the same walkway that the Apollo astronauts walked to go to the moon. We then strapped into the vehicle and waited out for the long countdown sequence to, which took us at 6 seconds before launch to main engine ignition. The engines are run up to full speed, the vehicle lurches and shudders under the force of those engines, then suddenly the solid rockets fire and you feel this huge surge of energy and you're thrust upwards and you're on your way. You can bring the sound up a little more if you want. About 2 minutes into the flight, the solid rocket boosters have depleted their fuel, and so they're just dead weight, so we fire explosive bolts which release them, as you see there, and at that point we then ride the main engines on up to orbit. Now, we carried in this vehicle a camera that was mounted on the flight deck of the shuttle, which shows the view looking over the heads of the crew. As the engines start, there it is, the vibration of the start of the engines, then suddenly you see a big lurch there. That's the launch. The whole sky lights up with the solid rocket boosters. They're like big candles, and we're on our way, going straight up. And if you look at the right-hand window, you will in a moment see clouds come by. Remember, this is at night, but everything's lit up because of the brightness of the exhaust plume. And there go the clouds as we climb up through the atmosphere. And 2 minutes into the flight, the next event is the solid rockets are blown away, and you'll see this big flash. There it is. And at that point, the solid rocket boosters leave you, and you just sit quietly on the main engines for another 6 minutes, 6.5 minutes, and ride on up into orbit. And before you know it, you're in orbit at an orbital velocity of 28,000 kilometers an hour. We open the payload bay windows. This structure that's on the extreme left is actually the docking fixture that the shuttle carries, and that's what will mate with the Mir space station. Once we got to orbit, we then did a series of rocket burns, which carried us around to speed us up a little bit so that we could catch up with the Mir space station, which was way ahead of us. The Mir space station appeared first as a very small point of light, but grew larger and larger as we approached it. And here you see us coming in, and we're actually going to dock with that yellow-colored module that you see at the bottom of the space station. Here you see a view coming in just as night falls. Shows how quickly night falls in space. Once we get very close, we slow down the approach between the two vehicles to a matter of a few inches a second and drive in and make contact there. The vehicles latch together and then screws come in and pull them tight together to make a seal between them. And at that point, we're one large orbiting vehicle. We check the integrity of that seal between the two spacecraft. And if it's good, we can then open the hatch and go aboard the Mir space station, which you see the commander of STS-89 doing here. So this was our first greeting with the crew of the Mir space station. They hadn't seen anyone for about 6 months, so they were very glad to see us. Now, this is not the crew that I flew with. This is a different. This crew had been there, and the crew I flew with were yet to arrive. But these guys had been up there for a while. I flew with them for a little while, but not most of the flight. I was actually with a different crew. And then once we'd said hello, we took a camera, a handheld camera, and floated into the Mir space station carrying the camera. And that's why the picture wobbles around a bit, because you're floating. And this is the first view of Mir I got, and this shows what it's like inside the Mir space station. And this was my home for 4.5 months. You see, there's a lot of equipment stored inside the space station. This is going down one of the long modules to the central node of the space station. The space station consists of four modules which are joined cruciform-like to a central node where there's a core module of the space station. And here we are coming into the central node. You roll around and into the core module there. And there you see myself with astronaut David Wolf on the right, and he was the U.S. astronaut who had been up there preceding me, and he'd been up there for 4 months, and he was ready to come home. So he went about telling me about how to live on the space station and what the day-to-day procedures were and so on. It was a handover. And then we went about packing up all his equipment and bringing it over into the shuttle for stowage on board the shuttle. And then once we'd done that, we unpacked all my equipment that I was going to need for my flight and carry that back into the space station. And that's what's taking place here. Once we'd finished the equipment exchange and consumable exchange, we all gathered together in the dining area of the space station, said our farewells, and then the shuttle crew left me on board and closed the hatch released the latches holding the two vehicles together and fired some small rockets to separate them, and the shuttle slowly backed away from the space station, as you see here. And this is one of the last views I have of the shuttle Endeavour as it was pulling away. It drifted off into the distance and actually went behind one of the solar panels on the Mir space station, and then I lost sight of it and I didn't see it again until the shuttle came back 4.5 months later. This then became my home, and I went about unpacking my bags, learning the layout of all of these modules that you see here, and learning how to live on the space station, and what the day-to-day procedures were, and just figuring out how you go about living on a Russian space station. Quite a large vehicle, as you can see. While I was doing that, the cosmonauts that I was going to fly with launched out of Kazakhstan in Central Asia to come up to meet us, and this is the launch sequence of the Soyuz rocket that they came in. And that's the Soyuz capsule that they use to exchange crews with the space station. And that capsule came up and docked with us, and we opened the hatch and welcomed them on board. And of course, the crew that had been up there were really glad to see this relief crew come, because that meant that they were going home. And after a handover period, that's what they did. We wished them well, and they floated into their Soyuz capsule, and we closed the hatch on them, said goodbye and closed the hatch on them, and watched as they drifted away. They fired some small rockets on their Soyuz, released the latches holding the two craft together, and this is the Soyuz backing away from the space station in preparation for return to Earth. Contains three people in very, very cramped conditions. And we watched as they drifted away, and they fired their rockets and went down into the atmosphere below us and out of sight. And we heard that they actually landed successfully a couple of hours later in Kazakhstan. This was quite an important moment for us, because that meant that we were now in charge of the space station. It was our facility, we were responsible for it, and we were the new crew on board. So we kind of patted ourselves on the back and congratulated ourselves and wished ourselves well, because we knew that we had a long time coming up ahead of us. I'm often asked how you go about living on the space station, and that's, I had to learn at that point how to live on a day-to-day basis on the space station. It's not an easy thing to do when you have limited resources of recreation and you're in confinement. But I have a video sequence here, or sequence of video shots, which show you what it was like to actually live on the space station for that period of time. Our time was, of course, based on Moscow time, because the control center that we worked out of was in Moscow. And we would get up at about 8:30 in the morning, and I would make the bed like you do on Earth, and then go about the daily chores of brushing my teeth and shaving and so on. And of course, everything you do is weightless. You're weightless 24 hours a day. So that adds a whole new dimension to even these very simple menial tasks of learning how to do them in zero gravity. It's a challenge, but it's a lot of fun. After cleanup, I would come to the central module of the space station and join my colleagues for breakfast. We ate all our meals together at this dining table, as you see here. Oftentimes we would watch a video while we were doing it, and that's actually what we're doing here. And you see us, we're watching a screen that's behind the camera, enjoying a Russian film. The food we ate was rehydrated food, so it was freeze-dried food, much like you have on camping trips. And we would rehydrate it at this rehydration station you see me accessing here. And basically you squeeze hot or cold water into the food package and knead it a bit to reconstitute the food, and then cut the package open and spoon it out and eat it. It sounds unpalatable, but actually the food was very good. I had a good selection of juices and vegetables and so on, and more than enough food. After breakfast, it was time to start my day's work, I had a radiogram that I would receive each day that would give me my assignments for that particular day, so I knew what I had to do. And I also had a laptop computer that you see in front of me there that I used as a work aid and also to write letters and things like that. The main part of my work day was to run a suite of science experiments that we had carried up on the shuttle. And these experiments were designed to look at the effect of zero gravity on various physical processes and biological processes. The experiment you see me operating here is a biotechnology experiment, and it's actually a bioreactor which is striving to grow human cellular tissue in an artificial environment in zero gravity. The argument for doing this is that because it's zero gravity, the tissue samples that form won't sink to the bottom of a vessel, and you don't get a problem with it called sedimentation, and so that they don't suffer contamination and distortion due to the presence of the vessel. So you, in principle, can grow a superior sample or amalgamation of tissue this way, and that was what this experiment was aimed to look at. We were actually growing two kinds of cells, human cancer cells and normal blood vessel cells. Because it was a biotechnology experiment, sterility was important, and you see me using the mask and gloves and so on to run the experiment. Another experiment that I ran here is a material science experiment. This was to create alloys in zero gravity conditions and to measure a property called diffusion of those alloys, something that's hard to do with these alloys in 1G because of problems of the heavier part of the alloy just falling, settling out. And this is a furnace which actually heated those samples, and I'm actually loading them into the furnace for a run. A large part of the experiments that we did was actually on ourselves, because we wanted to look at to see the way the human body responded to spaceflight. And so we would do ongoing monitoring of our own blood chemistry during the flight, doing blood draws and so on. And you see my cosmonaut colleagues doing that kind of work in the space station to measure the effect of zero gravity on the human body, because there is effect. And it can be serious, and we're interested in trying to develop steps to mitigate those effects. One way you can mitigate them is through regular exercise, and astronauts and cosmonauts do that when they're in space. And for me, on the Mir space station, the exercise system I used was a treadmill. The problem, of course, with a treadmill in zero gravity is there's nothing to hold it onto it. But you see, I have that harness there, and that has bungee cords on the sides, and I would bungee myself to the treadmill and then stand up with these bungees holding me down on the treadmill, and then I could go about some stretching exercise and a bit of walking and then running, and you could get a good cardiovascular exercise that way. But it's, I have to tell you, it's a very weird sensation to stand up and run in zero gravity. I did this once flying over Australia, and I like to say that I've run from coast to coast across Australia. That only took about 8 minutes, though. When you exercise in space, when I do, I sweat a lot. And of course, sweat won't run off you because there's nothing to pull it off you. It just accumulates on you, so you end up very wet afterwards. So I would use that as my opportunity for cleanup and bathing. And here you see me washing my hair. And you see, one of the problems you have is the bottle of shampoo needs to be Velcroed down, the comb needs to be Velcroed down. If you let go of the towel, it floats away. So there's a whole sort of ethic you have to learn about how you do these day-to-day tasks in zero gravity. After exercise, it would be time for dinner, usually in the early evening. I would float back to the central module here and join my colleagues, and we would talk about what we'd done that day and what we plan to do the next day, watch a video perhaps, watch movies as we are here, perhaps write letters, read books, and then it would be time for bed. And I'd unroll my sleeping bag and climb into it as you see here, and I'd use those cords you see holding it to hold it down onto the floor so that it wouldn't float away while I was sleeping. You notice I don't have a pillow because you don't need one in zero gravity. Your head will just float to whatever position is comfortable. During the course of this flight, the cosmonauts did a number of EVAs or spacewalks, and here you see they've just gone into the airlock to don their spacesuits to go outside to do repairs in zero gravity. And they would go outside and get onto this boom, which they would then use to move each other around to different work sites on the outside of the space station, a very effective way of moving from one point to another. One cosmonaut would be on the end of the boom and the other person would be at the end, driving it, cranking it around. And there were a number of repairs they did. You may remember that last year one of the unmanned resupply vessels that periodically visits the Mir space station actually collided with the space station and damaged some solar arrays. And there you see the damaged array in the lower right of the picture. The task they had were to go out and put a brace on that solar array so that every time the space station moved, the array would not flap around, so to speak. And this is what they're doing out there, and you see a few sequences of them installing that brace on that solar array, and they were successful in doing that. Another task that they did, the second series of spacewalks, was to go out onto this tower that you see there. And on the extreme right of the tower, you will see that there's a box. And that's actually a rocket engine which is used to change the attitude of the space station as it moves around the Earth to keep the solar arrays pointed at the sun. Well, that rocket had actually run out of fuel, so they had to discard the old rocket engine and then install a new one. The engine was in a box about the size of a typical desk, so it was quite large. And to do that, they had to first put this ring that you see they have there around the tower to give them a place to stand so that they could then access the rocket engine and disconnect it and release it. In a moment, you'll see them actually release it. Once they've installed their worksite, you'll see them release that rocket and let it fly off into space. Working in zero gravity like this looks like fun, but it's actually very difficult because you see they're wearing these very bulky pressure suits, and everything they have has to be tethered down or you will lose it. So it's a very labor-intensive activity to do this kind of work. And here you will see them release the rocket engine. And there it goes. And it drifted away from us and drifted down in the atmosphere a few weeks later and burned up. They then had to get a new one from the unmanned resupply vessel that had brought it up, take it up to the end of the tower and install it and make all the connections to it and get it running again. And they were successful in doing that, but it took quite a lot of work to do it. It's a fine piece of work. I mentioned these unmanned resupply craft. This is one of them leaving us. Periodically, we'd put all our dirty laundry and our garbage and trash and everything into this craft, undock it remotely, and it would fly away from us down into the atmosphere and actually burn up somewhere over the southern part of the Pacific Ocean. And this is one of those leaving and going down into the atmosphere. It's very similar to the Soyuz capsule they use. As soon as one had gone, they would then send a new one up. Here you see it arriving. They sent it up from Kazakhstan. And that was a great moment for us because it would bring food and fresh food and letters and treats and chocolate and things like that for us. So we always look forward to it when they came up and docked with us. One of the great things about flying in space, of course, is enjoying the view. And I've got a video sequence here of the views you see in a typical orbit. This is, of course, looking south over the United States at Florida, my launch site being on the Florida Peninsula. And this is the view you see coming over central U.S. looking to the south. If instead you look to the north, in winter, as I did, you see this ice up here in Hudson Bay in northern Canada. Very stark contrast to the tropics of Florida. And on the right there, you see those two circular features. These are actually ancient meteor craters that are filled with water, which is frozen as ice. And you see these really fascinating ring structures. And it was very striking to fly over Canada and see these beautiful rings, white rings, lying down on the surface of these ancient meteor impacts. Very spectacular sight. Coming further east into the North Atlantic and Newfoundland, you see here these white shapes that you see on the right of the picture. These are actually ice floes in the North Atlantic. And the ice was also a very striking feature because if you looked at it closely, as here, for example, in a late afternoon shot, you find it forms these wonderful filament shapes that follow the ocean currents. I expected to sort of see jagged plates, but you don't. You see these beautiful filaments of ice threading out over the ocean. They're really beautiful to look at. Very surprising sight. The North Atlantic, though, is an area populated by very fierce storms that come up from the south. And this is one storm system that came up from the tropics back in February. It was several hundred kilometers in extent, a huge, huge storm system that I saw in the North Atlantic. Coming across in the eastern Atlantic, we strike Africa. This is the Sahara. And if you zoom in close on some of these regions, you see once again there's another ring structure here down on the ground. And at first you might think, well, this is another meteor crater, but in fact it's not. What this is a volcano, an ancient volcanic crater, and those dark regions you saw were lava flows from the ancient volcano. Coming further north of Africa, a very familiar sight I'm sure you all recognize, upside down perhaps from our normal perspective, but this is of course Italy. It was very striking to see Italy because it was, you know, the characteristic shape of the boot was so very evident every time we'd fly over it. I enjoyed flying over the Mediterranean because there's so much interesting land to see there and so much history there. Here we have Greece in the upper part of the picture, and coming in at the bottom right, the island of Crete. It was a beautiful view over the Mediterranean, the deep blue ocean and the coloured land surrounding it. Here's the eastern Mediterranean. Cyprus is just going off in the top left below the solar panel. And we see Israel, and you can make out the Rift Valley and leading up to the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. And down on the bottom left of the picture is Egypt and the Nile Delta. Again, a region that's been very important in the cultural development of human civilization. And this is Egypt, and that thin white line you see just left of center, surrounded by green, is actually the Suez Canal running up there from the Gulf of Aqaba, right there. And the green regions you see over on the left were the Nile Delta. Coming further east, we see the largest natural structures on Earth, and that's the Himalayas. And these are the snow-capped peaks of the Himalayas running across the top part of the picture. Above that are the deserts of China, and below that is the subcontinent of India. Here is China itself. Beijing would have just gone off left of picture. We're over the Yellow Sea. And you notice the fog and haze over the land, and that was a characteristic you'd always see in China because they have very heavy reliance on wood-burning stoves and coal-burning stoves. So you'd very often see this smoke and haze over the land of China. And this is coming back to India again, on the southern part of India. On the left is the very southern tip of the Indian subcontinent, and to the right is the island of Sri Lanka, or Ceylon. And you see there's a very thin filament of land between the two countries. You notice also the cloud cover there just follows the delineation of the land, and that's because the clouds are created by thermal convection from the hot ground. And it was very striking to see the clouds just following the patterns of the land exactly. After you fly over the dark blue of the Indian Ocean, it gives away to the very dark red of Central Australia. And this is a view I'm sure that you'll all recognize coming across South Australia. And in the left of the picture there, down below the salt lakes, you see that circular salt lake. It's Lake Gardner, I think. That is actually an ancient meteor impact crater as well. You see the dark blue of the oceans. You can see clearly the two gulfs there. And, of course, Adelaide. You can see the outline of the Mount Lofty Ranges, and to the north up near Port Augusta, the Flinders Ranges, Kangaroo Island, and so on. And I should say the speed that you see us following over the ground here is the actual speed that we flew at. And that gave us an orbit every 90 minutes. And coming a bit further east is Victoria and Melbourne. It was perhaps hard to see because it was very dark, low sunlight there. And in the bottom right of the picture is the island of Tasmania as we head out over the Tasman Sea and into the Pacific. The Pacific was a very turbulent place, a lot of clouds always in the tropics of the Pacific, and a lot of storms which we could see, and these were some storms I saw over the northeast part of Australia and out into the Pacific Ocean, responsible for a lot of rainfall. After you cross the Pacific, we'd make landfall at the US. And this was some scenes one day coming across, actually, the Central American Peninsula around Nicaragua and Mexico. And you see, again, it looks very clouded, much like those views of China. And you sort of see hints of land poking their head up between the clouds. It turned out that this was not actually cloud. This was, in fact, smoke due to the fact that they had fires there that they used to control land for farming use. And those fires have got out of control, and were creating these huge plumes of smoke that would travel hundreds and hundreds of miles, leaving a charred land below. In fact, I once was flying over Chicago and I saw a smoke haze drifting off down to the south over Florida and originating in Mexico. And if you think about that geography, it gives you an idea of just how extensive these smoke plumes are. And while I was living on the space station and enjoying the view, the crew of the shuttle that were coming to get me were undertaking their training in Florida in preparation for their launch. This is the crew of STS-91. And they flew up in the shuttle Discovery to come and get me in June. Here you see them walking out, just as I had done 4.5 months before, and strapping into Discovery. We had a camera on board again, and this shows what it's like to actually strap into the space shuttle. Remember, that it's up on its back because it's going to be launched, so you have to haul yourself up into the seats like this and strap yourself in. Not an easy task. And this is a view looking down at the flight deck while technicians are standing essentially on the wall behind the crew, helping them strap in and prepare them for the launch. Once again, we have a sequence of main engine start. And liftoff. Now, that camera that you saw during this launch was faced to poke out the window, and you'll see what it looks like, the view out the window, when you launch in the shuttle. Here it is. And you'll hear the crew comments. There's the exhaust. And there, you're on your way.
Going uphill, all looks good. We're in auto. There's a roll. Here's the Discovery roll program.
You roll, you see the beach go by. Out over the ocean.
Back and enjoy the ride.
Through the clouds. Riding that vehicle in space, I think, is the penultimate experience that anyone can do in the latter part of the 20th century. I don't think there's anything that can compare to it. The onboard camera was also used to record the booster separation. Here you see the solid rocket boosters as viewed from the belly of the shuttle as they're jettisoned. At that point on, you're riding the tank up into space. And once the fuel in the tank is depleted, we then jettison the tank, as you'll see here. Notice all the shards of ice that it's carrying with it because it had cryogenic fuel. And it too burns up over the southern Pacific Ocean. It's just an empty tank. So, I looked out the window one day, and this is the sight I saw, and it was a grand sight to see the shuttle coming in, moving initially quite quickly towards us. As it drew closer, it slowed down, and it fired its control jets to change its orientation to match its attitude to that of the space station. And then fired small jets to bring it to drift it slowly in to make contact. And here you see it coming in. The two docking fixtures coming together. Hand contact. Once contact is made, you then clamp the vehicles together and you check the integrity of the seal, and if that's good, then you can open the hatches between the two vehicles. And that's what we're doing here, and welcoming the crew on board. This was a great moment for me because this hatchway had for 4.5 months been just a wall, and I knew that there was only space on the other side of it, nothing. And then suddenly one day it opened and my colleagues came floating through. So we welcome them aboard. And we had a small ceremony in the dining table, and the shuttle bought some fresh fruit and things like that and chocolates for us, so we were kind of glad to get those. And then we went about the business of packing up all my supplies, all my science experiments, and preparing them for the trip home and stowing them in these bags you see here in the shuttle. Once we'd done that, we recognized that this was a fairly historical moment because it's the last time a NASA crew will ever visit the Mir space station. So we signed some placards and plaques sort of commemorating that event, and then exchanged some gifts, and we said our farewells to the two cosmonauts who were remaining on board. So I wished them well, and then I turned around and floated down the tunnel into the shuttle for the last time, knowing that I would never see the Mir space station in that way again. They closed the hatch on the space station side. Once that was done, we then checked our hatch and closed it on our side, making sure that we had a good seal. After we'd done that, we all gathered on the flight deck of the shuttle and watched as we released the hooks holding the two vehicles together, and the pilot fired some small thrusters and slowly backed us away from the space station. And I got to watch my last views of the space station drifting away from us, getting smaller and smaller in the distance. It was good to see it from that perspective because I'd been inside it so long, I'd never really seen the outside of it. We didn't land immediately. We had to stay in orbit for a while doing some science experiments. So I used the time to get as much exercise as I could because I knew I was going to have to adapt to gravity when I got back. And after about 3 days, we donned our suits and prepared for the journey home, strapped into our seats and fired the thrusters to slow the shuttle down, to plunge it back into the atmosphere for re-entry and land at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Here you see it coming in, a high altitude view. This is the view out the pilot's window as he's doing this turn onto final. And for aviation buffs, the speed is on the left in knots and the altitude is on the right in thousands of feet, and it gives you an idea of how quickly the shuttle sinks to the ground. There it's turning out, lining up with the runway, and coming in for landing. And remember, this is a gliding landing. It's unpowered, so it has to be done correctly the first time. At about 500 feet, the shuttle flare. They flare the shuttle, bring up the nose to slow it down, deploy the landing gear, and come in for touchdown. Main gear touchdown first, followed a little later by a touchdown of the nose gear, and then roll out. The touchdown speed is quite high. It's about 200 knots, which is a lot for a 100-ton vehicle. So we use the parachute to slow it down, saves the brakes a bit. As we rolled out onto the runway, I was feeling gravity for the first time in 4.5 months. I had completed in the 141 days that I was in space, that's 20 weeks and one day, I completed 2,250 orbits of the Earth, and if you unwrap that distance, it's about 56 million miles, or the best part of 100 million kilometers. And that basically concludes the flight video, and I hope it will give you some idea of what it's like to do one of these missions.
Now you've got all that. Any questions? Please, if you're asking questions, if you're from the media, give your organisation first. And if you're from the general public, it'd be polite to give your name. Thank you. And keep your questions brief, please.
My name's Steve Johnson. I was just going to ask, I've heard some astronauts say they have a spiritual experience, whatever they may call that. Did you have something similar?
I've heard that story. It's largely anecdotal, actually. I think it stems from the Apollo days. And I think there was one astronaut who had fairly strong religious convictions, but it's not nearly as commonplace as you might think. I did not see it that way. I think when you do an extraordinary experience like that, as I've probably, you may have heard me say a number of times, you interpret it within the framework of whatever belief structures you have. And for me, it was an extraordinary expression of the capacity, the creativity of the mind to make this vehicle that could take me up there and bring me back and live that way. An extraordinary accomplishment.
Alec Matheson, we could all make suggestions as to how to improve things. Having spent so long in space, were any good practical suggestions you could make to improve life in space?
Well, that actually is ultimately the reason why NASA sent astronauts to the Mir space station, and so that we can then step up to the next space station, the International Space Station, with some experience behind us on how best to do it. And from these flights that we did to Mir, we learned a lot. We learned how to get the shuttle up to Mir and to rendezvous and dock with it. That's not a trivial task, actually, in Earth orbit. And we learned how to do that. We learned how to exchange supplies and consumables. We have a lot of ideas on that. We learned how the Russian culture works, how they go about the training of their cosmonauts. We learned about their space hardware, information that would have been totally inaccessible to us 10 years ago. For those of us that flew, we have a lot of personal experience that we can relate so that we know how you have to live up there, what you need, what resources you need to live in a space station. We also have a lot of prosaic suggestions, like what's the best way to package food, what's the best kind of clothing to have, what the best kinds of notebooks and things like that. You know, what resources should crew persons have? So we got a lot of answers out of this program. What did I miss? The biggest problem you have in a flight like that is that you don't have a lot of options for recreation. If you think a normal week, you might do lots and lots of different things as your recreation each week. Well, you don't have those options when you're in space on a flight like this. You have very limited options, and so you need to use what's there as best you can to keep yourself psychologically regenerated and to keep motivated. And that's the big challenge about doing one of these flights, is learning how to do that.
On the left.
I'm Ross Philpott, and wonder if you'd be good enough to look ahead into the future. The year 2003 will be the 100th anniversary of the flight of the Wright brothers, and I wonder if you would care to look ahead another century after that and guess where we might be there.
Yeah. You know, if someone had asked the Wright brothers to conceive of a vehicle like the space shuttle, I'm sure they could not have. I think if you try to look ahead more than a few years, you're just guessing. I can speculate what space travel is going to do in the next few years. We're going to build the International Space Station. I think then you will see a concerted effort to have a human presence on Mars, probably within 20 years. I think that is quite doable. At the same time, I think you'll see a return to the moon. In fact, I think they may even use the moon flights as a basis for experimenting with systems to use on a Mars flight. Beyond that, it would be pure guesswork to speculate what's going to happen.
On the right.
Dr. Thomas, Peter Adams from ABC Radio. Welcome back home.
Thank you.
You've been here for a while. Given Russia's obvious economic problems, what impact did you see that having on the space the Russian space program while you were there, and what do you see in the short term for the Russian space program?
Yeah, actually, when I was there last year, the economic situation was a lot more stable than it is now. But a large part of the motivations I think the Russian Space Agency had to work with the U.S. was because of their economic shortfalls, and it was a source of money to them and sponsorship. And what we're seeing is that a lot of the commitments that we are looking for from them are being slowed down because they don't have the resources to keep going at the rate they had originally planned. So the biggest impact we're going to see is a slowdown of the deliverables from their contribution to the International Space Station.
Did you see any impact on safety margins in the operations in space?
No, I didn't. A lot of people have questioned about the safety of Mir because, you know, it did have a very colourful history last year. But if you look at what the Russians really did, if you really look at seriously, as I did, following the problems last year, they worked very hard to re-establish stable operations on that space station, and they did that. I had a remarkably trouble-free time there, and I think that's to their credit. And the Russians have had a lot of hard press against them, and I think they recognized that, and they knew they were on the world stage, and they needed to step up to getting good operations on Mir. And I think they deserve credit, perhaps more credit than the press give them, for what they have done in getting that space station and maintaining its operation. It is, after all, the world's first reusable orbiting laboratory for long-term spaceflight.
On my left.
I'm Paul Davies, and I'm a private citizen, but I'm here today on behalf of the Advertiser newspaper. If Australia has a space program, it's almost invisible. I think Canada spends about 20 times as much as Australia on space. Should Australia do more in space exploration, and if so, what?
Yes, that's a question I'm also asked a lot. In fact, I was in Canberra earlier this week for the dedication of a small space exhibit at Questacon, the Science and Technology Centre in Canberra, and there was a lot of talk there during the presentations about all of the space activities going on in Australia, and they pointed to the Japanese landing tests that were done at Woomera, and they pointed to the Kistler launches that occurred, and a lot of these things, and it was quite striking because not one of them was sponsored by Australia. None at all. And I think that was actually a fairly sad statement. And equally poignant was the point that this interesting space exhibit was being set up at Questacon by NASDA, the Japanese Space Agency. And these kinds of exhibits are an important source of motivation for young people to study science and engineering. And I think it's sending a very interesting message that young people go and see space and it's no Australian labels on it. So what could Australia do? Australia could clearly do a lot more. Australia is blessed by a geography which makes it ideal for potential launch sites of rockets because it's near the equator. And that's very important when you try to launch a rocket because you can use the equator, the spin of the Earth, to sort of fling it up. It makes a very big difference to how much payload you can get to orbit. It would be wonderful to see a launch capability developed here on Australian territory. It would provide a huge influx of foreign capital if it was developed and became a prime launch site in the next century. It would be an incredible source of inspiration and motivation for young people to study science and engineering, perhaps become astronauts. And those people may not work in the on space technology for a long time, but they would get trained in that, and then they would go into society in other areas, taking that knowledge with them. So that knowledge would diffuse out into society and enrichen the whole society. And that, I think, is would be a really wonderful thing were that to happen.
Thank you. On the right.
I'm Rudolf Teutzen. I'm a private citizen who, about 5 years ago, covered the German-sponsored D2 mission as a media liaison officer.
Ah, yes.
The International Space Station, you've mentioned that, has been on the drawing boards for quite a long time, and that's put a lot of pressure on me, in fact. What's the time frame? When do you see the first astronauts go up to live on the International Space Station? And is there a chance for Australia still to play a part in that?
Yes. The schedule, the build schedule for the space station is actually under review right now because of the issues that we just talked about of the Russian problems. The first element of the space station is supposed to go up in November. And I believe that will still happen. We won't see a crew on it probably for another year, though, before it becomes tendered. And it's about a 5-year build cycle. Is there a role for Australia? Certainly. In any capacity. There will be a lot of interesting science experiments going on. Australia could certainly use its strong tertiary education resources, its research and development resources, to fly science experiments up there. I think the experiments should be chosen to be something that would serve the interests of the Australian community and be a resource for the Australian people at large. So you'd have to choose these areas of scientific investigation fairly carefully, I think. But that's doable. That would just require a very small, modest investment. At the other extreme, Australia could actually build hardware and build sizable pieces of hardware for it. Australia could fly crew persons on it, should they so desire. Those are all possibilities. But none of that is taking place at the present time.
On the far left.
Dr. Thomas, Milton Howard, World War II. While you're still probably coming down intellectually and emotionally, is there one standout memory you have, or is it still an odyssey to you as it was to us?
No, I still have a lot of memories for it, from it, particularly when I see the video that I showed you. It brings a lot back. Standout memories. One was certainly a point about 3 or 4 weeks into the flight where I had realized how I needed to live up there. I had worked out what recreation tools I could provide for myself, and I'd sort of made that transition from the life, a terrestrial life, to the life up there
and I realized that it was all going to work just fine and I was going to have a good experience, and I did. And that to me is probably the single most important personal reward from the flight, because before I went, I wasn't sure how I was going to do that. No one is until you're there and you have to do it. And that was a very big step for me. And other things that stand in my mind was sometimes looking out the window, the extraordinary view. I remember one very striking moment flying over the Southern Ocean, and I couldn't look to Australia because the window was facing the other way. I looked south and saw the Aurora Australis, and this was at night, as this shimmering curtain of green light, and that was just an absolutely breathtaking sight to see from space over the entire southern polar regions. It was, for some reason, particularly bright at that particular time, and really an amazing sight.
On the right.
Darren Hinch from 5DN, a two-pronged question. Having covered Apollo 11, the triumph of Apollo 11 and the near disaster of Apollo 13, would you agree that Apollo 11 showed American ingenuity and technological skills, and Apollo 13 showed astronaut skills? And the second part of the question is, with men and women both in space these days, have you ever heard of an astronauty?
And the answer to the last part's no. I wouldn't say Apollo 13 was just astronaut skills. A large part of the success of bringing the crew back was due to the extraordinary capabilities of the people on the ground to figure out how to make it all work with what they had.
Cheryl Nixon from Australian Associated Press. You talked about the human presence on Mars within the foreseeable future. Do you see yourself playing a role in that? And can you tell us a little bit more about what that would entail?
Yeah. Well, if it happens, I suspect it probably won't happen for 20 years or more, and I think that will be probably beyond my professional lifetime, John Glenn notwithstanding. What it will entail is there's a number of mission scenarios, but the most likely scenario is that a rocket would leave Earth orbit and travel there for 6 months and arrive at Mars. It would have no crew on it. It would land, and then it would begin the process of using the Martian atmosphere to generate propellant, to make methane from carbon dioxide. And it would fill its tanks with methane and also oxygen. And that would then be a fueled rocket in place on Mars for a crew to use to come back. And once that had been completed, Mars then would have come around to a good conjunction with the Earth again. A human crew would leave, and they would spend 6 months and go to Mars and land there next to that rocket, and that rocket would be their return ticket home. They would either come home very quickly while the Earth was still close, or probably remain there for a full orbit of Mars around the Sun, 500 days, doing investigations, building a habitation, and then come back. And as they come back, another crew would probably go out to hand over, so there'd be a semi-permanent presence. That mission requires 6 months there, 500 days on Mars, and 6 months back. So it's about a nearly 900-day mission. That's a long time. That is doable, though. It's very interesting. There is no sophisticated research and development needed to go to Mars in that scenario I just described. We actually have the technology to do it. What you need is a very large booster, and we don't have one of those right now. We did have one with a Saturn, but it was mothballed and none are flying. Haven't for 25 years. But all we need is a large booster to do that, and we know how to make a large booster. So it doesn't require a development program along the lines that Apollo required, but it does require a national commitment. I think that will happen eventually, or probably an international commitment, and I think that will happen after the International Space Station is flying.
On the left.
Yes. Mike O'Reilly. I have two questions, one's from myself and one's from my son Patrick. From me, I couldn't help feeling just a little anxious when you were filming your compatriots who were outside on the end of that great long stick doing all those amazing things. How did it feel that you might suddenly find yourself awfully alone? And if they went off like that engine. And the other question was, when will you be doing it again, from my son?
Yeah, that was actually an interesting time, because at that point I was the only one on board the space station. They were outside, and I was in charge of the space station and running it. So I did sort of thought, well, what would happen if they don't come back? Well, I would have got into the Soyuz capsule that was there, and I would have come home. But that was an extremely improbable scenario.
It wasn't realistic to consider that. I didn't think that it would come down to that, and I wasn't concerned about it. What will I do next? I hope to remain in the flight pool when I go back to Houston and fly again in a couple of years, perhaps one of the flights that's doing the assembly of the International Space Station. I don't know if I want to step up to another long flight, at least not just yet, because it does require a huge personal commitment to do it. But certainly another shuttle flight or even two shuttle flights is out there, I hope, for me.
Straight in front of us here.
Yes, Nicole Hart from Radio 5AA. I was just wondering how many of your experiments you're actually able to talk about and how many are set as being off-limits to public knowledge.
Oh, none of it was classified or anything like that, if that's what you mean. It's all public domain. I'm free to talk about them with the limited knowledge I know of them in terms of their outcome. We brought those experiments back and they actually continued to run on the ground a bit in some cases. I can't give you a lot of details about the findings of, for example, my body chemistry during the flight. Some of it's actually restricted because it's private medical information, but also because those tests are ongoing. I'm still in the post-flight phase where I'm being monitored, and as the other crew persons have done this are. And I can't tell you too much about some of the other experiments because the analysis is still in progress, and I have not been given the results of that analysis yet.
On the left.
Andrew Short. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about the view at night, evidence of man from space, and also how you're coping with gravity.
I'm coping with gravity quite well. The view at night is very striking because city lights are so in evidence. After I did those exercises, you saw me running, I would often go to the window with my Walkman and listen to music and look out the window while it was on a night pass on the night side, because we're going around 16 times a day, and just enjoy the view at night because it was sort of so peaceful and serene, and you could watch thunderstorms lighting up clouds way below you. It was very interesting. You could see meteors streaming into the atmosphere below you. That was a striking sight. You'd come across Australia and I could see the lights of Adelaide, Melbourne and Sydney all in one view laid out in front of me. And you probably heard me say I never saw the lights of Canberra. There weren't any lights on.
I think we can take four more questions. Four more.
Okay. Alan Collier from ABC Radio. Over here. Ah. Not one of the waiters. I'm at ABC Radio this week. Could you tell me...
Could be Channel 9.
No, that's just all my former news editors. Could you tell me, how long does it take to get down to Earth? I mean, physically and mentally. Once you come down to Earth, how long does it take to sort of realise and get used to being a human being again?
Yeah, the second part of the question that I didn't answer over there about readaptation. Physically, to get back to Earth, you fire the engines to slow yourself down and you land about an hour later. That's how long it takes. And usually that burn of those engines is over the Indian Ocean, and then you glide in over Australia and over the Pacific, re-entering over the Pacific, and then re-entering over Mexico, over the Mexican Gulf of Mexico and into Florida. That takes about an hour.
I was thinking more in terms of I'm back on Earth.
Yeah.
I'm back to life and getting back to do normal things. You're up for 140 days.
141.
Sorry to cut you short, but I'm a journalist. But you're up for 141 days in so many minutes, and it's for other people, getting back out of a holiday routine would be difficult. What's it like to come back and get into a bit of a work routine? And when will you be actually physically going back to work and not entertaining people at these sort of functions?
Oh, I'll be going back to work next week. I think what you're talking about is how do you adapt to being in the Earth's gravity again after you've been out of it for such a long period of time. And that was perhaps one of the most interesting aspects of the whole flight, because when I landed, I got to feel gravity again as if it was a totally new experience. And that's pretty unique, because we take it for granted. It's there with us all the time. But I got to feel it as if I'd never felt it before. And so it was really strange. I mean, the first time I stood up, I just couldn't believe how heavy my legs were and the effort required to pick up your legs and place one foot in front of the other. And that lasted a week or so. And after a couple of weeks, I thought, well, I'm ready to go running, thinking I was fine. And I got the same feeling again. As I'd try and run, just the effort required to pick up your feet and place them in sequence was really amazingly difficult. You have a lot of interesting side effects from when you come back. Your sense of balance is not very good. I got enough balance back within a few hours to be able to walk. Although I would turn my head, I would have false cues of rooms and cabins moving around me and everything spinning, which is a very standard response. But to get back really fine balance skills took about 2 weeks, which was interesting. It was a long time, 2 to 3 weeks, in fact. Another thing is, you know, of course, in zero gravity, you never stand on your feet. You're always floating. So the soles of my feet became very tender, like baby's feet. And so I couldn't walk on a hard surface for a long time just because my feet would be so sore. I'd have to wear very soft padded shoes. And, of course, when you start walking after you've been in space for that length of time, you're putting muscles back to work which haven't been used for 20 weeks. And so they start to complain, even though I exercised a lot. These muscles started to complain. And so after a few days back on the ground, you feel incredibly stiff. You feel like you've run a marathon without training for it. And so you have to do a lot of stretching exercises and things like that to loosen up. So that gives you an idea, I think, of what it's like to go through the readaptation process. It was interesting. Someone when we were landing on the runway, I was lying there in the shuttle. Someone passed me a camera to take a picture, and I just held it in my hand. I just thought, my gosh, how do we use these cameras? They're so heavy. I mean, the weight was just unbelievable. It was an extraordinary sensation.
One on my left over here.
Frank Crouch from the Sunday Mail. Just following on from that last question, space travel looks fantastic, but it's all obviously hard physically and mentally. How much of the human species do you think is capable of going into space?
Oh, it's not as hard as you might think. The early flights certainly were very difficult. But, you know, John Glenn is going to fly next week, and he's 77 years old. The acceleration you feel in launch is about 3 Gs. You're lying on your back. That's actually not that bad of an acceleration. It's only about 1.5 Gs coming back into the atmosphere. That's not that stressful. It gets stressful when you have to climb through hatches and things, perhaps if you had to do an emergency bailout, when you're pulling a lot of load on the vehicle and things like that. But it's well within the range of most human capacity to do this. It doesn't require that you be a Schwarzenegger or an Olympic athlete to do this.
We've got two more. There's one over there on the left.
Hello, Andy. Amanda Lynch. I'm just wondering about the impact of the Challenger disaster and whether there was a loss of confidence in the NASA space program.
Well, I think there was at that time when that happened. And NASA very seriously looked at the way they did things and instituted procedures, new procedures of operation, to avoid the kind of thing that was happening in that program, and to ensure mission safety. And I think the flight record suggests that that's been very successful.
One on the right, and then there's the last one will be over here. There's one on the right over here.
Hi, Michelle Baker from Exposure Management. Was the John Glenn mission just a publicity stunt?
Well, the ostensible motivations for that are based on some science to look at the effect of zero gravity on aging and so on. But I think you have to be perfectly realistic that it is a publicity coup for NASA to do it. And it's certainly something John Glenn very much wanted to do. John Glenn is something of an icon in the United States because he was one of the people that started the whole space program. And I remember as a child listening to him flying and reading about him. And it's extraordinary now to be sort of sharing a career with him, and his office is a few doors down from mine. There has been a huge positive response in the U.S. to his flight. People are just enormously excited by it, to see this man going back into space sort of at the end of his career. And I think that's good. I think it's a great motivator for people. I think it's good.
The last one's over the left, over here.
Lynn Page from Scouts Australia. Andy, I was wondering, given that you've already achieved so much, what personal goals have you set for yourself to achieve over the rest of your remaining career and your personal life?
Well, I still wish to fly again. I don't consider that this part of my professional life is over. So I would like to fly again, as I said before, perhaps a couple more times. I would actually really like to go to the moon. If we had a moon program, I think that would be just a great adventure. Unfortunately, I think I'm probably not in the running because of age, but I would really like to do that.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think someone's given us a very wonderful experience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I hope you find time for some very nice South Australian red wine. Ladies and gentlemen, Andy Thomas.
Thank you.
Wasn't that absolutely wonderful? What an inspiration. Ladies and gentlemen, before we actually draw the winners of the raffle prizes, and I know you're probably in a hurry to get back to work, we're going to do a one-off quick auction. Qantas have provided a couple of airfares, and the dollars that we raise on these will assist the administration of the press club because, as I said before, we are non-profit. Anthony Toop is with us. Where are you, Anthony? Anthony, come on up, and he's going to do the quickest auction he's ever done. Of course, everybody knows Anthony. He's one of South Australia's leading real estate people.
Thanks, Sue. Okay, the instructions are pretty clear, so it needs to be very quick indeed. But it is for two people, and it is by Qantas. And just as an aside, very quickly, the new state manager of Qantas, Martin Port, has arrived in town to replace Peter Collins. So welcome to Martin, and thanks for getting off on the right foot and donating some of these trips. So 28,000 kilometres per hour. I'm not sure whether Qantas will quite maintain that sort of speed. 90 minutes might be to Melbourne or Sydney, but I don't think we'll get quite around that entire globe, Andy. And one other comment just before we get this underway, don't forget to look out of the window. I heard that comment halfway through, so what a good comment. Let's get it away. What have we got somewhere to get us away? We've got a couple hundred thousand, that'd be good. Got 200 in the back with Alec at 200, you bid at 200, you're done. At 3 in front. At 300, you bid at 300, you're done. At $300 and you're done. And 4. At 400, you bid. At $400 and you're done. All done, silent at 400. 5. At 5 in the front. At $500 you bid. At 500 you're done. At $500 and you bid. All done, silent. 550 with Darren. At 550 and make it 56. At 6 you're bidding against you, Darren. At 600 you bid. At 600 then you're done. At 600 you bid. In the centre at 600 you bid. What about Dean? At 600 then you're done. All done, silent. Sydney or Melbourne. 650. At 650 and Alex back in again. At 650 you bid. At $650 and you're done. At 650, 700. At 700 against you, sir. At 700, you've been. What about the right? At 700, then you're done. At 700 in the centre, all done, silent. At $700, you bid. Worth a lot more than this. All done, silent. Has to be quick, Sue. 50, make it quick. Gotcha. At 750, then you bid. At 750, you're done. At $750, all done. It's a great trip. Sydney, good excuse. Let's do it. At 750, then. 8. At 800, you're bidding, Paul. At 800, then, with Darren, at 800, you bid. At $800, all done, silent. Alec, you're out of it. At $800, you're bidding. At $800, you're done. Bit quiet in the centre. $800 done. All done, silent. And sold. Darren Hinch, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anthony. And thank you, Darren. And our treasurer, Jim Mattock, will be feeling a lot happier now. OK, we're going to draw the raffle prizes. We are one envelope missing. Whose envelope is not here? Down the back? Could we have it up here, please? Thank you. Also, where is Grant heading from Channel 10? I'd like him to come up here and... Grant, come on up and draw the raffle for us. OK, get your raffle tickets out. Stir them up, Merle. Stir them up. Oh, yeah. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, could I have a bit of shush? You might win something really nice. Grant Heading, the news director of Channel 10. Please welcome him up here, member of the Press Club Committee. Okay, first of all, for overnight accommodation for two people at the Stanford Grand Hotel in a VIP suite with a cooked breakfast, who do we have, Grant?
Rebecca Morse.
G62. Rebecca, come on up. The voucher is there. A Telstra 500 cordless telephone valued at $199. This is a nice prize from Telstra.
There you go, Rebecca. Well done.
Another one. Okay. Who have we got, Grant?
H7, Ian Goad? Good?
Ian Good? Hey! Ian! Where are you?
Which is from Telstra, is it?
It is H7 and it's blue. From Telstra? You're joking! We're doing it again! He's not having his phone!
Okay, we have G97. Mrs. Rivers?
G97. It's a bit hard to read. Mrs. L. R. something or other.
Rivers, G97.
Happy Valley. She lives in Happy Valley. Where are we? Quick, quick. Down the back.
Okay.
Come on up.
Come on up.
That's for the phone. Okay, but this is a really nice prize. A case of the Advertiser 1998 Royal Adelaide Wine Show Dozen. Courtesy... everybody wants this one.
Yes, what's that?
Margot McGregor from the Hotels Association.
Margot McGregor from the Hotels Association. Now, Margot, I hear you're on the wagon, so are you throwing this one back?
No, she's not. No, she's not. Margot deserves this. She works hard. Yay. Margot. We have, thanks to Grant here, we have two tickets to the official Network 10 Variety Club luncheon, Melbourne Cup luncheon in the main arena at the Adelaide Entertainment Centre, where we're going to have hundreds of people, valued at $120 for two tickets.
It's a pinky. Pinky C18. Wayne Brookman.
Wayne Brookman. Good one. We have access to Telstra's Message Bank Home Service for 12 months, valued at $60. Plus, we've also got a Telstra business card holder and pen. And, Ian Good, you're out of this one.
A yellow G27, M. Walker.
M. Walker. M. Walker. Yes. Where is Alan Rogers from Ragone's? Alan, come on up. Alan very kindly, every Press Club luncheon, gives us two vouchers. Here he comes. Here's Alan. He's got... This next one is a $50 voucher from Ragone's Bistro in Lee Street to enjoy some traditional and modern Italian cuisine. A great place to go and eat Ragone's.
Okay, it's a white ticket. White ticket, H13, P. Callahan.
P. Callahan, H13. Here we go, here we go. Gone. Somebody collect it for him. And we have a $50 voucher from the Rock Lobster Cafe in Gouger Street, which is a wonderful place to eat. Specialising in local southern rock lobster and other exotic food. Alan's got the voucher for that too. C1.
Yes, C1. Oh, Lord. Marjorie Moore. C1, anyway.
Table 43. Great one. Here she comes. And finally, from SA Brewing, a carton of Southwark Pale Ale, which is their new brew, and a nice cap. A thank you to Robbie Cooter at SA Brewing. Who have we got, Grant?
It looks like an orange ticket. H71, Sandra, is it Sandra Brocker? Brockner? No, sorry, Orange.
Here she is. That's all done. Ladies and gentlemen, a reminder that the next Press Club luncheon is on November the 12th with Donald McDonald, Chairman of the Ring Cycle and Chairman of the ABC. Thank you for your attendance today and thank you, Grant.